understandably feel, especially if there's family members present, that our job or our role is to fix suffering. That success, what would success look like in this situation? Well, that a person was struggling and suffering, and then I would come in, and we have to admit, it would just be wonderful if because of my playing or my prayer or my ritual or whatever it was, suddenly there's this sort of beatific transformation. And that may happen. But the instinct of that Afro-Iberian strand of the tradition, where we get a lot of the great writers, the great mystical writers who write about the dark night of the soul, the John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila school of thought, for example, their perspective would be that it's kind of like spiritual homeopathy. When we see suffering, if we come and too quickly sort of salve it over, we may just be pushing it deeper, and there can be another kind of suffering. That sometimes what we want to do is be, and this is where you have to trust instinct again, be agents who can support, in some ways, the magnification of the suffering. I'm not talking about physical pain, but if something's been buried for a long time, and now, you're running out of time, and the soul knows that, there's a kind of urgency, and I don't want to numb that. Maybe a person's entire life has led up to this moment. There's some kind of breakthrough that's about to happen, something that maybe could not have happened in that person's life under normal circumstances. But now under sort of the pressure cooker of mortality, there's an opportunity for some profound kind of breakthrough and insight. But as those things are often preceded by, it's kind of like the birth pang, just there can be this extreme sort of suffering that just precedes that. And to, first of all, sort of know that, again, through enough story, through enough history, to trust that when we see that happen, we ourselves don't panic. Because, it's bad enough to be in a room where we see family members who are just feeling horrible. And again, it could be that the appropriate thing is to come and help sedate the person. I'm not being anti-analgesia, but also to recognize that there could be, at some emotional and spiritual level, a real breakthrough. There's a birthing going on. So how could I be there to not stop the contractions, if you will, but to lean into them, because I know, in fact, that there's going to be a period here of enhanced suffering before that gets transformed. So that's hard to trust, because again, we'd like to fix it, and that's where I would have to defer to Tina and in terms of how musically one might sort of address that situation, because if a person is screaming, it could be that, they're just trumping any other sound that's going on in the room. But would there be some, I can think of other kinds of techniques and tools about how to be present to that pain. But I'm wondering, Tina, maybe if you could address in that situation what would or would not be helpful in terms of someone who had a harp in the room, for example.
Well, one of the things that's not helpful, which you touched upon before, was to try to diss the person's pain and try to move into something where you're not acknowledging it. So it comes back to that very intuitive process of finding out how long you stay musically within the contemplative music, where they have that chance to experience it, work through it, and then when to modulate out of it. But one of the things that I'm thinking is it's not always something that happens right at the end when you take your breath. I'm also thinking about the process of the couple days before somebody lets go. And there are a lot of ways that have been written in the Cradle of Sound book from the man who was so angry he wouldn't let anybody into the room, none of the doctors or nurses or chaplain. And then I was finally asked to go in there with the expectation I'd probably be shouted at and told to get out. And as a result of it, I'm sure they've all read it in the book right now, but the short story of it is that this man started singing along with a song that just came out of the sky blue air, and I had no idea what I was playing, and it turned out to be a very meaningful song for him back to his childhood. And for 3 days before he passed away, he had that opportunity to work through that pain and do it through music. One of the most memorable times that I had at hospice that I remember was this one man who was in a lot of pain, and a lot of family members around. There must have been 12 people in the room. And he was always wincing, and the family was there, and there was a lot of commotion in the room. And finally, they all decided that they were going to go down and get something to eat at the cafeteria. And so they all left, and I was able to be there alone with him. And at that point, I was able to work with his resonance, and all of that pain had left his forehead. And he was able to just totally relax and go into that deep breathing from his belly. And just, it was like he was finally letting go. And at this point, his son came running into the room. Apparently, he had just arrived from some other place. And he looked at his father, and he started shaking him and saying, Dad, talk to me. And at that moment, I had to just reach over and touch the son's shoulder and say, he's not going to be able to really respond to you right now. What do you have to say to him? He can hear what you have to say to him. And he just kept shaking him. Dad, talk to me. And at that moment, the father passed away. So in thinking about that incident that happened and talking about it over the years, it was actually, it falls into the same category. When people say, if I play for somebody, am I going to cause them to die? And it's really that we don't have that power over a person. They have the power to choose when they're going to die, when they're going to let go. And this man, he had that ability to be able to take those deep breaths and wipe away all of the pain just before his son came in. And then when his son came in, it was almost like an act of, like, my son is here and I'm ready to go. But it was a very, very potent experience for me that stayed with me for a long time.
That's beautiful. I think it points to that tradition that really does show up in a lot of the Asian traditions of living and dying. And again, this is from antiquity. I'm not saying this is how it's followed anymore, but where the person who comes in, who's invited in to a situation where someone is actively dying, and your family members, is invited to be, if you will, sort of the orchestrator of the situation. And in some ways, this is where you have to be careful, because obviously this is a very tender time, and family members may resent intrusion. But as you pointed out, sometimes the energy that's holding a person back is exactly the rest of the energy in the room. The anxieties, you know, of someone who's just in horrible grief in the presence of someone who's dying really confuses the soul of the person that's dying, and that's how the Tibetan Book of Dying would say it. So the role of the priest, the lama, in that situation is to be there. Also really with an eye on everybody else in the room, and sort of energetically, and again, this is helpful when a culture draws out of this tradition, but sometimes the job of the lama is to remove a certain presence from the room because they know instinctively that this is not going to support the person in death. And we know of how many stories in hospice where a person very faithfully is keeping vigil, and they leave the room for a short period of time, and the person finally lets go, and that's because that person needed some space. So if we can gently sort of be mediators between the different energies in the room, I guess it comes back to that that point I made at the very beginning, sort of the unfettered heart that can welcome higher energy. So when I'm in a situation that is very, very chaotic, and I'm not judging that, I'm just noticing that that's what the energy is, either on the part of the person who's in their deathbed or, you know, among family members. If I can move to that place, if I can open up, if you get the language, my heart chakra, then I can welcome that higher energy of spirit in the room. And it's amazing. It's actually one of the most useful tools that you can do. You can really, really trust this. When you're throwing your hands up and there's nothing else you can say or do, you're just absolutely, you know, pushed to the wall, you can drop to a contemplative place. And this is why, in my work, I am just increasingly convinced that the most effective people in being with others in suffering are those who have a deep, regular contemplative practice. I just don't know any other way around it, because you can be very bright intellectually, but if you don't know how to drop to that place in the midst of chaos and hold that space, then it's difficult to invite that higher resonance and to trust that that resonance, that spirit, whatever you want to call it, is the energy that will transform the situation. And sometimes you can literally watch that happen. You can watch chaos, you can drop to it, and love is more powerful than fear. And one loving heart in that situation, just closing your eyes, moving to that place, maybe humming, whatever, again, intuitively comes, can be, it's not doing nothing. It's doing something very, very important for the energy in that room.
Right. We have a couple questions here, Richard. I'm going to open up the mic to Jan Hirsch. Jan, you have the mic, and do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. I do. Thank you. As I was listening to you, Richard, I thought of my son. His first degree was in anthropology, and he also has a degree in nursing. He had the wonderful experience of spending a great deal of time with the Navajo people in Arizona, and his role was as a health caregiver. And he experienced their ceremonies, which are very rich. And I as you talk about the Celtic tradition, I see a great similarity with indigenous people and the richness of their experience, and the fact that they embrace the spirit world as the Celtic people do. With the indigenous people, there doesn't seem to be such a separation between the living and those who have passed onto another world, and that those people are respected and ever near us for help. And they have no qualms about, you know, seeking the wisdom of those who have passed on, and how death then is not so much shunned or an alien experience, that there is always that connection between the living and the people who we no longer see, who are no longer with us in our everyday life, and yet they're in spirit. And we in the Western world have kind of shunned that philosophy with our modern and miracle medicines. We don't think of death as something very real sometimes, because we have so many things in medicine that can keep us alive, save us. Our children don't die with bronchitis anymore or pneumonia because we have the miracle of antibiotics. So I know even in the hospice in our area, they are having troubles because people will not call hospice because they cannot accept the possibility of death. They would rather go for the one miracle treatment that may keep them alive another day. so they tend to call hospice at the very last moment. And I was wondering if you could comment about that, Richard, please.
Yeah, thank you, boy. Very rich comments. Several things come up as you were sharing. I didn't have the best reception, but I think I heard the essence of what you were saying. I heard the reference to the Navajos, and boy, talk about one powerful tradition. Let me just say a word about that, because obviously, as Tina said, you know, you can't, you don't impose a different cultural point of view at the end of life. That's not going to be useful. However, and this kind of follows on the comment I was making earlier about being in the midst of great fear and suffering and opening up our heart so that it can become a channel of that higher vibration and that everybody else in the room can benefit from that. But in many Native traditions, and the Navajo in particular, that I have some familiarity with more than others, and I'll just kind of translate this into my language, and again, you'd have to find the way that this works for you. But there would be a real profound belief that in moments like this, axial moments, moments when the worlds, the veil between worlds is parting, certainly death is one of those times, that those of us who have the privilege of being present to that, and the belief that there would be, this is not accidental. If you have the privilege of being with someone, then the belief would be in this tradition that soul called you to be there. I'm translating this into my language now. And that one of the gifts that you can draw on is that in that moment, and this is, I think, those of us who would be therapists of any sort could draw on this, that we have the possibility, the potential, to become literally channels of higher spirit and of those others, the ancestors, those who have gone before, those who really love this person and are on the other side and would most now at this point want to come to that person's aid and assistance. But they need an incarnate channel, and I know this can sound kind of scary and kind of strange, but again, if you translate this into whatever tradition you might have, this would be the communion of saints if you come from a Catholic tradition, Christian tradition, that you would be there very much not alone if you would become centered and not drawn out into the outer world experience. But if you could move to the inner middle world experience, that we can be there in that situation, literally channeling, holding space for all of these other wonderful presences of love that really would want to be there now, helping to midwife this soul in a time of suffering. And I just find that a very humbling kind of belief. It's one that, to be honest, I default to when I just have nothing else that I could say or do. If I can move to that place and to that belief and hold that possibility that I'm becoming a channel of light for all of these intermediaries who are sort of showing up now at this important time, what a great gift. First of all, it helps me. I'm not alone in this. I don't have to depend just on my own resources. And I can trust that my instincts or intuition is really being guided by something larger than myself. So you're right. We don't have that kind of language, certainly in recent centuries in the West at all. But it doesn't matter. That's the truth. I mean, that's the perennial wisdom that our ancestors knew. And one person showing up who holds space for that possibility, who has the unfettered heart to be able to bring in this higher vibration, it doesn't matter what that people at this point study this or believe it in some kind of a verbal way. People will experience the parting of the veil, And often, even some of the most cynical people who don't even know what they believe about anything beyond physical existence will have a profound sense afterwards that something happened in that room, something happened in that moment of transition. And sometimes it just needs one person to be there as a witness to that. So I think the power of witness, and, you know, you have more of an advantage of doing that, frankly, when you're there not enmeshed emotionally. But if your own mother dying or your own child or your own spouse, oh, gosh, your job is to be there, you know, in that way. But I think the caregiver has the advantage. The anamkara has the advantage of coming in. We care, we love, but we're not emotionally enmeshed. And so it gives us a kind of a clear lens to hold space for that healing and that higher. So thank you for your comments. It's a beautiful part of the work. And I think whether people in our day and age believe in that or not, one person coming in with, you know, who can hold that space, I think can still help make the magic happen.
Thank you, Richard. I think that's just a really powerful thought, that the more that each one of us works on our own contemplative practice so that we can be the channel of that light coming through, for that energy coming through, not only to receive the musical inspiration that's needed, but to hold that space where that person feels that there is something else at that moment. I've seen it many, many times, including with my own father, that there's this just kind of recognition right at the end, like, wow, this is such a mystery, such a mystery. Richard, we have three more questions, and we have about 15 minutes. So let's gauge the next three questions from the three people with about 5 minutes each. Okay? I'm going to open up the mic right now to Sable Shaw. Sable, you have the mic.
Thank you. It was more of an observation. While Richard was talking about the insight following the suffering, it brought to mind what Jeff had been talking about in terms of chaos leading to balance. And I saw it as another connection of that chaos leading to balance in the future.
That was so powerful, wasn't it?
No, that's it. You don't just sort of get that theoretically. You have to have practice. You have to sort of go into this kind of almost a spiritual war zone sometimes to experience it. And then come back, and I think we need places where we can share our experiences with others. I don't think the anamkara, in my language, can do it alone. And that's one of the disadvantages in this culture. So we get a little training, and then we're sort of off there by ourselves. So I think whatever communion we can create, where we can share our successes and also our fears and our failures, there'll be a lot learned from that. Because, boy, chaos is overwhelming. Fear takes over there. And I can sort of know preemptively that I won't succumb to fear. But I think the wisdom traditions knew there was a special kind of training for that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Richard, I'm going to open this up next to Anita Leeshied. Anita, you have the mic.
Thank you. Just hearing Richard and Tina reminded me of one of my most powerful moments when I was at a hospice setting, and it was a room full of the family, a large family, and I knew a lot of them didn't want me there. There were lots of tears, and I was making the wife, my presence and the music brought the wife to a lot of tears, and they were all looking at me, and I just feel so dagger. But I concentrated on the dying man, and I just played for him. And it was quite a length of time, but the tears stopped. The wife looked at me and asked if I would play Lord of Dance. And the family members around the husband and the father sang that song together while I played. And it really was, you know, it wasn't just my cradle of sounds, then it was everybody's cradle of sounds. So I often pray, it's a lot easier to go in when there's no family members. But when there's that complication, you're right, Richard, you're trying to hear the other side talking to a lot of Krishna. Anyway, it's still powerful. So thank you, Richard.
Beautiful. Yeah, I think, you know, the key point there, too, for me is just the humility, the prayer, the intention, going in, you know, again, we know the difference between just mechanically playing a sound, saying a prayer, whatever, and the difference when pure intention is behind that. It drives it to a profound place. So constantly to before going into a situation, to remind ourselves what we're doing, what it's about, and to go with a sense of humility is probably the best medicine for any of us, especially if we're in this work professionally and doing it all the time.
Thank you. We have two people here. I'm opening the mic right now to Carolyn Worcester. Carolyn, you have the mic.
Hi. I don't really have a question, but I'm appreciating the call, and I'm listening to Richard again. This is really helping me a lot, and I'm identifying so much with so much of the experiences that people are sharing. I just wanted to say there's one thing that's been happening. I've been working in harp therapy for, about 3 or 4 years now, and I work with a variety of populations, and one of the things that's happened to me in the last, I think about a year, is people come up to me out in public all the time and say, oh, you played for my relative at hospice, or I have a picture of you playing for my mother-in-law, or you're the harp lady, or you were this, or you were that. I almost never know when that's going to happen to me, so it was a little unnerving at first, but when I reflect on this, and we're talking about the vibrations that we are sending out from the instrument of our harp and connecting soul to soul with all of these people, that doesn't stop when you leave the room. It lasts, and it feels to me like, you know, we're touching, this is a very intimate experience, and we're touching people, and we are woven into the fabric of their experience, either with their dying family member or their stay in the hospital or wherever we've met them. And it goes out far beyond that one moment. And this has been, it's almost like I'm kind of experiencing almost the reverberation coming back at me. And I don't have, I just want to share that as something that's been happening to me. It's like voices, I don't know if you would call it echoes or just, you know, just coming back, that it lasts far longer than the moment that you are physically present. And I'm finding that very humbling and remarkable and very satisfying in kind of a comforting way to know, I mean, talk about doing something meaningful. It's kind of blew me away the first time that happened. And in a related way, I appreciate, and Richard, you keep using the word vibration rather than music or sound, and I think that's another thing that I keep at the most elemental level, what we are creating with our, I mean, if you put your hand several inches above the soundboard, on even on those little harps when you're playing, you can feel that vibration even if you're not touching the instrument. And it's a physical thing. And I just want to, for anybody who hasn't done Module 2, so all the students out there, in my Module 2, Tina played, and I was on the floor. I was one of the people that got to experience her playing in different positions around our bodies. And when she was down by my left foot, I physically felt this, you know, sound go through my foot, up my leg, up to my heart, and wrap around me. And I physically felt like I was being held. And I went, oh, that's why she calls it a cradle of sound. It's not a poetic